Good morning. Welcome to the Filson Historical Society. I'm Julie Skosky, and I have the honor of being the vice president here, and we're so delighted to see this wonderful group here this morning. It is now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Leanne Weitz. She's director of research here at the Filson and editor of our journal, The Ohio Valley History. She's the author of many books and articles having to do with the Civil War era, and her most recent book, co-edited with Lisa Frank, is Household War, Homefront, and Battlefields in the American Civil War. And it will be coming soon from the University of Georgia Press. So, Dr. Weitz.
Well, it's great to be here. You know, it takes a long time to put together these academic conferences. And this academic conference, From Colonial Encounters to the Iraq War, Prisoners of War and Their Place in History, was actually born in the Hard War academic conference that the Filson did. That is, the idea for it was born at that conference, because both Lorian Foote and I were at that Hard War conference in 2014, as was Adam Dombey and perhaps others of you. And at the end of it, Lorian said, well, this has been such a great experience. Why don't we do Prisoners of War? And why don't we ask Daniel Krebs to be the co-convener on this conference? He would be perfect. And I said, great idea, years ago. And then these things happen, and it's really wonderful. So I'm really appreciative of my co-conveners here, Lorian Foote and Daniel Krebs, and I'm happy to introduce them now to give a collaborative keynote. So Lorian Foote is a full professor and director of graduate studies at Texas A&M. Where she teaches courses in the Civil War era and also military history. She is the author of many books. My favorite so far is The Gentleman and the Roughs, Manhood, Honor, and Violence in the Union Army, published by New York University Press in 2010, but she has quite appropriately a more recent book on prisoners of war entitled The Yankee Plague, Escaped Union Prisoners and the Collapse of the Confederacy, recently published by UNC Press in 2016. She also does digital history in her spare time when she isn't cranking out the books, and she is the creator and principal investigator for a joint project of the Center for Virtual History at the University of Georgia and also Texas A&M. That is mapping the movement of 3,000 federal prisoners of war who escaped from the Confederacy, which is the kind of research, you know, we can only do now. I mean, we can know so much more about how movements of people went on. And our other speaker today and fellow co-convener is Daniel Krebs, who is an associate professor from the University of Louisville right here, where he also teaches military history, but his time period of specialization is the colonial era and the American Revolution. And he is the author of A Generous and Merciful Enemy, Life for German Prisoners of War During the American Revolution, published in 2013. And he has begun research on a second book focused on the life of Brigadier General Daniel Morgan, the Old Wagoner, and the rise of the American West. And I debated whether I should include this or not, but I think that the people who are on this program have really interesting back histories. It's just a really interesting group of people. And so I'm including here, next to his academic employment, Daniel serves as a reserve officer in the German Army with the current rank of Lieutenant Colonel in the German Armed Forces Command, USA and Canada. So you can talk to him about what all that's about on the break. And also, on the break, please help yourself to more of these pastries. Otherwise, the Filson will be eating 2-day-old, 3-day-old. We'll be eating those forever. So help yourself to that. So, Daniel and Lauren.
Well, First of all, I have to thank Leanne for the wonderful introduction, but most importantly, for all the work she put into this conference. You guys, the presenters, and also the visitors and listeners, really, Leanne is the heart of this conference, and we thank her for that and for all the efforts, and of course for the Filson to be willing to take on a topic like prisoners of war, because as we will probably all talk about today, it's been for a long time not one of the most fashionable topics, and so to take on an issue like that and provide some of the funding is really amazing, and I would like to thank the Filson really for willing to put up in, you know, Lorian and me and indulge us in this conference and in this symposium, and Leanne for all the work that you put in here, because without you it was really, you know, would not have been possible. So thank you very much. So I need my clicker. Oh, there it is. Okay, good. Today and tomorrow, together with you, Lorian and I, we want to study the integral role of prisoners of war and how they play that role in economic, cultural, social, political, military waging of American wars. We want to examine how and in what ways prisoners of war played an active role, and that's really what we're stressing, an active role in the conduct and outcome of American military encounters. We want to showcase, in other words, recent approaches and insightful findings as represented by your work and research. Lori and I are then planning to publish some of the results of this conference in a collection of essays, because we really think that too often in the past have historians dealt with prisoners of war only as this kind of like special, separate topic from separate from military history, separate from warfare. Prisoners were defeated soldiers, subjects to the whims of captors, passive victims forgotten when the next battle erupted. If discussed at all, what we often find in the historiography is that prisoners of war usually only make a brief appearance as casualty on casualty lists, as sums, as numbers, as burdens often. More men to feed, supply, house, guard. And in the 19th century, and forgive me for the next, you know, today and tomorrow, I'm an 18th century guy, and I usually blame the 19th century for about everything. So in the 19th century, it got even rougher for prisoners of war, because now there were these men that did not give everything, their life, for the nation, for their cause. With our introductory remarks today and in this morning, Lori and I want to present several of our ideas that go a little bit in a different direction. And with you today and tomorrow, we want to press even further. And reading all your presentations made me very excited. I think we have some really terrific stuff coming up here. I will begin by focusing a little bit on the earlier periods of American warfare, particularly from my work, as Leon mentioned, on German POWs during the American War of Independence. Lorian will then concentrate on her work surrounding the Civil War. And in the end, we want to submit for your consideration a number of takeaways that we, you know, maybe use as a guide for our discussions today and tomorrow. So let me start first by thinking about prisoners of war and thinking about some definitions. The term prisoner of war really acquired legal and precise meaning only in the 20th century. After the Hague Conferences, 1899 and 1907, and of course the Geneva Conventions, especially the Third Geneva Convention as it was revised in 1949. Before Western warfare, and that's what I'm focusing on a little bit here, really only knew a set of customary rules when it comes to prisoners of war. We called it the laws of war. And they were rooted in ancient Greek and Roman warfare. You can see here one of those reliefs. Christian teachings, medieval traditions of knightly warfare. They gave us these customs, these traditions, up until, as I said, these big conferences at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and trying to redefine what is a prisoner of war. In Greek warfare and also in Roman warfare, POWs were really and literally enemies taken with a spear. And you can see it here, some of those captives. So they were personal property. Somebody personally captured somebody with a spear. and then brought him home, either sold him as slaves or used him for other purposes. Similarly, Roman warfare also, prisoners became captors' booty. That was the initial standard for prisoners of war in early Western warfare. In the medieval world, armies were then led by relatively few aristocratic knights. Armies were much bigger, and we had a lot of common soldiers or commoners in those armies, but our sources, they rarely mention those low-ranking commoners that made up the actual bulk of the army. Among aristocrats, then, captivity was a similar to Roman and Greek tradition, quasi-contractual relationship between noble captors and captives. Normally, some sort of ransom payment then freed the captives relatively quickly, with some exceptions, like, you know, Richard II. You know, we all know that famous story, how he got stuck there in Austria. With the advent of larger armies in the 14th and 15th century, with the advent of gunpowder on our battlefields, this distinction starts dissolving. The strict distinction between worthy and unworthy opponents in the battlefield really became untenable. Nobles could now be killed by an arrow, by a bullet, fired by a commoner, and also be captured by a commoner. Captivity in those larger mercenary armies was now no longer seen as a personal misfortune. It was really regular experience. Soldiers now actually demanded assurances that their state or army would ransom or exchange them quickly if they fell into enemy hands. And that was done regularly. Mercenary armies were expensive, and neither side wanted to let soldiers linger in enemy hands for long. In the 17th and 18th century, we often find cartels, treaties, that regulated POW exchanges even before the first battles, the first campaigns even started. In the 19th century, and, you know, again, blaming the 19th century, in the 19th and 20th century, however, we see more and more POWs in enemy hands for longer periods. General exchanges become much less common, and many of you in your presentations touch on that. At the same time, though, belligerents increasingly accepted that these prisoners of war, as lawful combatants, deserve better treatment. Whether they get that is a different debate, but they deserve better treatment. That meant, though, that fewer groups actually were entitled to that status. That's at least my observation. So we have fewer and fewer people on the battlefield that were actually entitled to the status of prisoner of war, and thus also entitled to that better treatment for prisoners of war. When thinking about prisoners of war, and this is what I took from my German historian Rüdiger Overmans, who studied prisoners of war, particularly in World War II and also World War I. We also have to get away a little bit from just seeing them as in their life in captivity, and we have to understand that they have certain functions, and they can fulfill many of those functions on the battlefield and afterwards in camps, and even after their release. And Rüdiger Overmans here stresses that prisoners of war could really be hostages, bridges of communication, consumers, proof of military success, objects of indoctrination, tools of propaganda, agents of social change, and even political instruments. And I'm excited for today and tomorrow that we're exploring in your presentations many of those themes and those functions that prisoners could have. To explain some of these a little bit more, please allow me to give you several examples now from my own research on German POWs in patriot hands during the American War of Independence. And I'm going through the life of a POW, so to speak, the way into captivity, life in captivity, and then the ways out or the release from captivity. And when we're thinking about the way into captivity, what we really have to think about is that soldiers become POWs usually in two ways. Either by capture, and that meant that in battle they're overwhelmed by the enemy or overpowered, or by surrender. And you see here a surrender scene from Yorktown, 1781. And surrender meant that there is a submission to the enemy of some kind, usually preceded by some kind of agreement, usually a verbal or sometimes even written contract, formal, informal, that regulated that process of surrender. Capture or surrender in the 18th century ended violence for both sides and allowed both sides to make it through the fighting alive. That was very important for the 18th century. Again, in the 19th century, that seemed to change with the rise of nationalism and this idea that you don't just fight for some kind of pay, but also for a cause, for an ideology. Soldiers on the verge of surrender, and I think that applies to all times, really had to be convinced that their submission would actually save their lives. The moment of capture and surrender was one of the most dangerous moments for a soldier on the battlefield, because obviously one soldier, one side, had to give up the protection of their weapons and had to place complete trust over their lives into the hands of their captors. For the 18th century, what I find, and you see here one example, what I call rituals of surrender regulated the process of turning soldiers safely into prisoners of war, usually by way of what we also still know as rites of passage, these strict rituals. And you see one example here from Yorktown. You have usually, after a siege, and that was common in the 18th century, surrendering soldiers marched out of their garrison or town, and you can see it here. We have here the surrendering German and British prisoners marching out of town, and thus they separate themselves from their previous status as defenders, as fighters on the battlefield. Then they would lay down their weapons. You see that you can't see it here. It's off this. It's just a detail from that painting. Would usually lay down their weapons upon orders of the enemy, and that means they will literally cast off the symbols and the weapons and that their status is as soldiers, and they become prisoners. And then they march off to some kind of camp or some kind of holding area as prisoners of war, and thus become and incorporate a new status in that society now as POWs. Yorktown in 1781 during the American Revolution was the clearest example of such rituals during the American War of Independence. We then have soon, and this is 1785, 1786, as you can see already paintings depicting that scene. The Patriots, though, in the American Revolution used these rituals to mark and communicate their victory. They wanted to show the world, this is who we are, we have won. We are the ones that have now defeated the British. By following the European rituals and traditions, like these marches, these rites of passage, the Patriots also established themselves as undisputed victors and respectable and legitimate belligerents. We are not rebels. We are not revolutionaries. We are belligerents, just like an English, a German, Prussian, other army that is fighting on 18th century battlefields. But the Patriots also used other rituals. For example, after Trenton, at a moment of crisis for the revolution, when in Trenton they captured around about 800 German POWs, they don't get these rituals that safely transport them into a new status in society, but rather they are led through Philadelphia just a few days later on a humiliating parade where the population is called out actually to humiliate, insult, and also throw, shall we call it, dirt at the prisoners. And were really showcased and humiliated. Here, the revolutionaries wanted to show their own people that we can defeat those enemies, we can do it. And by humiliating the prisoners and by degrading them and by threatening them, establishing their own power and strengthening their own morale. So this moment of capture, this moment of taking prisoners can be used by different kinds of rituals in order to boost morale, showcase a victory, or establish yourself as a respectable enemy in 18th century warfare. During captivity, prisoners from Trenton, to stay with that example, just humiliated in Philadelphia, were then transported to Lancaster, and this is just a little snippet. Lancaster was the first official United States POW camp that I could really find in my own research. complete with a plan that was drawn up in March 1777 that essentially outlined the basics of any prisoner of war camps ever since, with the stockade, today barbed wire, and the barracks, and where certain, the guardhouses, the graveyard, woodpiles, kitchens, hospitals, all of that is outlined on that plan. The irony, though, is that that the Germans that were let into that camp only stayed there usually for a few weeks, because what Americans discovered is that all of a sudden there's 800 potential laborers in their midst. Why would you let a group of young, usually young men, sit idle in a prison of war camp when you can use them as laborers? Within days after the Germans arriving in Lancaster, the American authorities, or I should say the revolutionary authorities, conducted a survey among the prisoners and counted 315 of them that had some kind of skill. Usually food, clothing, shelter, that those were the main professions. And over the next days, more or less all of the German prisoners disappear from camp and start working in the surrounding area. They really only come back to that camp for roll call or to receive pay that was still transported by their own army for them to Lancaster. And as such, not just as laborers, but prisoners were also valuable as consumers for the local economy. They brought in hard money. When the German army, when those Hessians sent pay to these prisoners in Lancaster, they brought hard money into the back country, and with that hard money, the local economy really started thriving. They had the laborers, they had consumers. So in that sense, we cannot overlook that prisoners also had an economic factor in that area. Another example here is Winchester, Virginia, after Yorktown that I just explained earlier, housing many POWs for months. Congress, though, in 1782 decided to move the prisoners away from Winchester into Frederick in Maryland. Winchester protested vigorously, petitioned Congress, "We don't want those prisoners to leave. We want them to stay. Don't take the prisoners away." And you think that, oh, wow, they're great people. They really want, to take care of these prisoners. The reality was that Winchester had found out that a delivery for clothing and money, again, was scheduled to reach those prisoners. And Winchester was simply eager to have that hard money, hard coin, that money in their economy. And they did not want Frederick and Maryland to now profit from that influx of cash in the hinterland. Congress did not relent, moved the prisoners, and a few months later, then Frederick, Maryland enjoyed all of a sudden an influx of cash in their economy and consumption by these POWs. Prisoners could also be used in order to use them as financial pressure points, if you will, on the enemy. And that happens also during the American Revolution and the American Revolutionary War. In 1778, for example, Congress finds out that the British at that time were struggling to supply their troops, and Congress immediately wanted to take advantage of that. They at that point, the American revolutionaries held more captives than the British, and instead of allowing now the British to supply their soldiers in enemy hands, as I just explained, with these pay deliveries through agents, the Patriots now demanded that the British pay them directly for the supplies delivered to POWs. To that end, to facilitate that pay, Congress now set an exorbitantly high exchange rate to the inflationary continental currency. In other words, making the British pay massive sums to supply their own soldiers in revolutionary hands. So clearly here, the revolutionaries wanted to put pressure on the British and used the prisoners for that. Parallel, a congressional committee in the same situation recommended that the Patriots should not agree to a POW exchange. If such an exchange were to happen, the committee argued, the British would actually gain well-trained, well-kept land forces, but the Patriots would only get back militiamen and seamen, and they would immediately return to the States and not at all bolster the ranks of the Continental Army. And the committee was very blunt in its assessment of that situation and very directly talked to General Washington about that. When it came to POW matters, the committee wrote, quote, interest alone and not principles of justice or humanity governs man, unquote. George Washington, who wanted an exchange badly because he wanted to, you know, take care of his soldiers in enemy hands, and the committee said he should not be, quote, dazzled with misconceived or ill-applied notions of honor. In other words, it just did not make sense at that time to exchange prisoners. So we understand you as a soldier, you want to do that, but let's face it, we have other interests, and the larger interests really trump here our concerns with the individual fate of our prisoners in their hands. Prisoners could also be used in order to control a less supportive population. Another example here from the American Revolutionary War, here it is Moravians, a Protestant sect in Lebanon, Pennsylvania, around Bethlehem, Lebanon, and the Lehigh Valley. This pacifist sect was suspected by the Patriots of supporting the British cause. And in order to control that population, and this is actually my interpretation of it, to take charge of that territory that they lived in, following the British invasion of Pennsylvania in 1777, the Patriots moved several hundred German and British POWs in that very region. In fact, they quartered them in Moravian churches. You see here one of those Moravian churches in Lebanon, PA. We have about 400 British and about 300 German POWs marching into this small town, 700 prisoners marching here into Lebanon, marching here into Bethlehem. And bringing POWs to these areas that did not support the Patriot cause, quartering them in these churches, in my view, brought the revolutionary state to town. Militia units arrived as guards. Provisions and transports were organized. Private property was seized. Revolutionaries installed even a large hospital for the Continental Army in Bethlehem. In other words, the war's home front had arrived in the area, and the Moravians now was forced to choose. Do we side with the Patriots, or do we suffer the consequences now that the revolutionary state has arrived here in person of these enemies, but also with all the state, the guards, and the requisitions that went with that? Leaving captivity, POWs can obviously leave captivity in different ways. Exchanges, as we already seen. During the American Revolution, the Patriots also regularly recruited among British and German POWs. Manpower needs for the Continental Army were simply too high. But for the first few years, General Washington and Congress actually were really reluctant and refused to recruit openly. The states had very few qualms among the states to recruit among prisoners. But at least the Continental Army did not recruit it until 1782. In 1782, following a proposal by Robert Morris, the Patriots offered several options to German POWs. Stay in captivity and suffer under increasingly harsh circumstances. Join Continental troops and be released immediately. Or stay in the United States as a settler, enticing, but only after a period of 3 years of indentured servitude. During those years, the POWs were then called upon working off the money that the United States had paid for their keep before. Any ideological concerns, as we can see here, were thrown out at that point. And this was interesting because, after all, this was a war that was not just another 18th century dynastic conflict. The Continental Army now in 1782 really looked and resembled European armies of the Ancien Régime. And we have a number of German prisoners that enlisted now with the Patriots, but that story gets a little bit more complex, and this is then the final point that I'm trying to make here. Here's an example of 50 German recruits that in 1782, after this change in Continental POW recruiting policy, enlisted on an American frigate, the South Carolina. These POWs had been captured early in the war, 1777, and had spent years in American captivity. But now they signed up in 1782 on this American ship. But soon after leaving its harbor, it was harbored in Philadelphia, the South Carolina was actually captured by the British Navy that is depicted here in that painting that I found in the National Archives in Canada, and brought to New York as a prize. The German troops now had again become POWs, this time in British hands, and were now arrested as American Marines. Upon arrival in New York, naturally, their own officers wanted to have a word with their former soldiers. Why had you signed up now with the Americans? These officers, though, heard a surprising story from their common soldiers. The man said that they had heard from loyalists in the area that the British were only waiting for the South Carolina to leave Philadelphia. The soldiers claimed, thus, that they had really only enlisted on that ship to use it as a vehicle for escape back to New York. Knowing that the ship would be captured, they knew that they would be transported back to New York. In other words, they presented that desertion and enlistment with the enemy as a clever way to escape out of a captivity. Surprisingly, the German officers really bought this tale. Reinstated the man immediately gave them even back pay, outfitted them with their weapons again, and sent them back to their regular units, quickly accusing the Patriots of mistreating POWs. What the soldiers, and we know that from British accounts, wisely did not tell their German superiors was that they actually had fought rather hard on a ship, on the South Carolina, against the British during that battle depicted here in that painting. Behavior one would obviously not expect from POWs who wanted to use this vessel only as a vehicle for escape. That was it from my side. I'm going to hand it over to Lorian now before we're coming back together on some takeaways. Thank you for now.
So good morning. I want to pick up a little bit with where Daniel left off in talking about, really, we're talking about thinking about how we're integrating prisoners of war into larger narratives of military conflict. And I think using the Civil War as an example of this is a good place to do this, because I view in the field of Civil War studies, we see an ongoing example of this. There has really been an explosion of scholarship on prisoners of war recently. I'm looking in the audience and seeing some of the graduate students, for example, that are doing some of this great work. I'm really seeing a difference. For so many years in the field of the Civil War, prisoners of war were treated as a separate topic. Prison camps were studied. This is very important to study them. Also, there was a lot of study about the treatment of POWs, why so many deaths, accusations about was the Union and the Confederacy mistreating prisoners. But we've seen in the Civil War field a shift to really integrating prisoners of war into their place and understanding some of the major themes of the conflict. So what I want to do in my remarks this morning is just give you three examples from my own research of how we can connect the story of POWs to other stories of the war. Just as an example from my own work, and then we're going to be seeing many more examples in the papers that are going to come in the rest of the conference. So the first thing that I want to do is show that it's actually vital in studying the American Civil War to connect the story of POWs to the story of cultural ideals of war and to military policy. Because it turns out that POWs were the tools that both sides used to negotiate major campaign and policy decisions during the war. So POWs are integral to the Union and the Confederacy deciding what does a civilized war look like? Because both sides, it's very important that they show that they're fighting a civilized war and that they show this into the Western world. But they don't agree what civilized war looks like. And POWs become the tool that they used to negotiate that. They're making claims before the court of world opinion that we're fighting a civilized war and we're going to negotiate what that looks like. And I'm going to give you an example of this so you can see what I mean when I say this. So what I have found is that there are four major issues that are points of contention between the Union and the Confederacy that POWs become the tool that they use to negotiate these points of contention. The U.S. Army's response to guerrillas and irregular warfare is one of the big points of contention. The second one is the treatment of POWs. The third one is the U.S. Emancipation Proclamation and the decision to arm African-American soldiers. And the fourth is the proper treatment of noncombatants. Those are four major issues in contention between the two sides. So I want to give you an example from the area related to the proper treatment of noncombatants to look at how this worked in practice, that both sides used POWs to negotiate the proper treatment of noncombatants during active military campaigns. So a major point that we see between the Union and Confederacy, a major point of contention, was the Union's arrest of unarmed Southern citizens and the confiscation of property. The Confederacy viewed both of these things as outside the boundaries of civilized warfare. By the summer of 1862, the Lincoln administration is increasingly turning to these two practices, to this military policy. And the Lincoln administration is facing setbacks in the summer of 1862, military setbacks, particularly in the Eastern Theater. They have a problem suppressing guerrillas in areas of active Union military operation. They're facing recalcitrance at best from Southern citizens that are under areas of Union occupation. And then there's pressure on the Lincoln administration to move towards emancipation and hard war from certain constituents in the Republican Party. So Civil War historians are familiar with what happened next. One of the things that happens in this context is the Lincoln administration brings General John Pope from the West and his experience fighting guerrillas in Missouri, and they bring him east, give him command of the Army of Virginia, a newly constituted army, and Pope is going to issue a series of general orders in Virginia. And so I've just kind of put these up here to give us a sense of what these are. So Pope's orders tell his troops that they can live off the countryside without compensating disloyal citizens. Pope is going to hold citizens responsible for any attack on Union supply lines. Any citizen who fires on Army personnel can be summarily shot. And any citizen who does not take an oath of allegiance to the United States will be put outside the Union Army lines. So for most historians, they view Pope's orders as part of the transition towards hard war, policies that target the morale and resources of the Confederacy as well as its armies. But most Civil War historians don't know the rest of the story here, which is vital to understanding what happens. So here's the rest of the story. We're getting to point number five. What happens next is Jefferson Davis instructs General Robert E. Lee to write the commander-in-chief of the Union armies, who at this point is Henry Wager Halleck. So Lee writes Halleck, and he gives, it's this wonderful letter where he talks about it is vital that we fight this war in a civilized manner, according to the laws and rules that are recognized by all civilized nations. It is clear to us that in the last few months you have veered towards, and I will quote the phrases that Lee uses in this letter, merciless atrocities and savage warfare. And then he gives Halleck a list of violations of civilized warfare on the part of the Union Army, which includes arming slaves in South Carolina and Louisiana, which includes the confiscation of property and the arrest of citizens, and which lists every one of Pope's orders. And Pope's orders receive particular vituperation in Lee's letter. Then what Lee says is, you have 15 days to retract these orders or tell us that they were issued without the sanction of the Lincoln administration. And if you don't do those two things within 15 days, we will retaliate. When Halleck does not answer that letter within 15 days, the Davis administration issues General Order Number 54 on August 1st, 1862. And here's what that general order says. Pope and every commissioned officer in his army are robbers and murderers rather than legitimate combatants entitled to POW status. They will be placed, if captured, in close confinement, and they will be reserved for hanging if the troops in the Army of Virginia carry out the execution of citizens. And if the United States does not retract its policies after this, the retaliation will be extended to enlisted men as a last resort. And Jefferson Davis explains that the reason he's making this declaration against commissioned officers is because enlisted men, once they enlist, they can't get out until their enlistment is up, and so they have no choice but to carry out orders. Commissioned officers can resign. So all of Pope's officers, if they didn't resign when they saw his orders, it shows that they were then outside the pale of civilized warfare, which means in the Confederacy's view, they're no longer legitimate combatants. They're felons, robbers, and murderers, and the leaders of insurrection. Okay? And an accompanying order to General Order 54 also declared that any commissioned officer who leads African-American troops is a servile insurrectionist and also will be subject to execution if captured and not subject to POW status. Now, what's really interesting to me about this, so that's General Order 54 and 60, is that as with every case of retaliation that I have researched so far, the side that is kind of subject to the retaliation will do some modification. This is a negotiation. This is a ritual of negotiation about how we're going to conduct the war. And the Lincoln administration will modify its stance after these, after General Order 54. First of all, they pressure Pope to modify his orders to make sure that his soldiers don't, and I'm again quoting the order here, pillage the countryside. Okay. Then Halleck issues War Department General Order 107 on August 15th. Now, this order is very interesting because it asserts that the international laws of war allowed for oaths of allegiance and allowed the seizure of private property for the subsistence of an army. But at the same time, it reminds soldiers and officers that they can be punished with death if they wantonly pillage a private house to loot property. Okay? So there's the United States is staking a claim. We are allowed under the laws of war to require oaths of allegiance, to remove people who do not do that. We're allowed to seize property. But we're also going to do a signal to show that we're not letting our soldiers run in a savage manner to just loot and pillage either. In September, the Lincoln administration informs the Confederate government that Pope's orders were no longer in force. And the Confederate agent for exchange immediately released all of Pope's commissioned officers that were held in confinement by the Confederacy. Now, what's interesting is this July-August 1862 incident inaugurated the use of officer POWs as the central negotiating tool, and this exemplifies the types of negotiations that would accompany every military campaign of the war. I have found, for example, that commanding generals in every major military campaign of 1864 implemented retaliation against POWs in order to protest a military policy of the other side. And the exchanges between the commanders follow a recognized ritual that they're clearly very familiar with how this negotiation is going to work. And both sides altered their practices. I don't have time necessarily to talk about it here, but there's a wonderful incident when Sherman is marching through South Carolina where some of his foragers, 24 of them, have their throats cut and are left on the road with a sign that says death to all foragers. So Sherman immediately executes 24 of his Confederate prisoners of war. But in the negotiation that he has with Wade Hampton, the Confederate general, they both draw their lines. Because in that negotiation, Sherman agrees. He says, you know what? I agree with you that any of my men burn houses. That's wrong, and I will not retaliate. I will not deem it wrong if your people shoot my men caught in the act of firing a house. Now, isn't that interesting? So there's true change in conduct that comes about through this ritual of negotiation. So my contention is we can't understand the evolution of military policy if we don't also include studying POWs and this ritual of retaliation that occurred during the Civil War. So that's one example. So a second example of how POWs can be connected to larger narratives is we can connect the story of POWs to campaigns, logistics, and particularly at the end of war, collapses militarily and socially that take place at the end of warfare. So I want to give you an example of how we can tell a story of a military campaign and its logistics that is connected to the story of POWs. So in September 1864, when Sherman captures Atlanta, the Confederacy has thousands of prisoners located in Georgia at Andersonville for enlisted men and an officer's prison in Macon. So the Confederacy has to shift all of these POWs out of Georgia to try to get them out of the way of Sherman's army. And along the way, there are 3,000 escapes in the process that is unleashed by this mass movement. But instead of turning to that, I want to talk about what happens once all those prisoners are moved to South Carolina, which is the main place that most of them are going to escape. By February 1865, the Union and the Confederacy have decided to go ahead and negotiate a general exchange of prisoners. This is, of course, the war is drawing to a close in February of 1865. And so both sides agree to an exchange of prisoners, and the Confederacy is going to deliver about 10,000 prisoners that it holds in South Carolina. And the agreement is that these prisoners are going to be exchanged at Wilmington, North Carolina. But the problem is, Wilmington, North Carolina, at that time, is right in the middle of an active military campaign. The context of February 1865 is that the Union has recently captured Fort Fisher, which was the last stronghold of blockade runners in the Civil War. And so here's the fort. You can kind of see the Cape Fear River, the peninsula that's going to run up. The peninsula that's going to run up to Wilmington. So at the time this exchange agreement is reached, federal forces are closing in on Wilmington from three different directions. Union troops are marching on both sides of the Cape Fear River, marching towards Wilmington, and the Union Navy has gunboats moving up the river towards Wilmington. So the Confederacy, in the meantime, is trying to bring these prisoners up from South Carolina to this theater of operation on the railroads, which I'll get to in a minute, right as the commanding general for the Confederacy at Wilmington, Robert Hoke, is trying to evacuate his garrison. So he is, and nobody's told him an exchange agreement has been reached, and nobody on the Union side has told John Schofield, the commander of the federal forces at this point, about the exchange either. So Hoke, all of a sudden, 2,500 prisoners show up at the railroad depot, and he's trying to evacuate his garrison. So I find this very fascinating. He sends a message down the railroad lines, and he says, don't send any more prisoners. He sends a message to the Union commander that says, I have 25 of your prisoners. Can I bring them to you somewhere? Now, Schofield doesn't know that there's been an exchange agreement, and Hoke doesn't say that in his message. So Schofield is really confused. He's like, I'm about to attack your city. I don't have time to pause and take prisoners accept any prisoners. And so Hoke says, he sends a message to his commanders of some of the troops in the outlying forts around Wilmington, and he says, okay, I gave you evacuation orders. I take that back. You have to hold on as long as you can to give me time to get these prisoners that have shown up out of the city. So what he does is he sends them back on the railroad. In the meantime, the other 7,500 are coming up by rail from South Carolina. So here's kind of the railroads. So what's going to happen is there's going to be absolute chaos on the railroads as these 10,000 prisoners are moved back and forth from points between Wilmington, Goldsboro, Raleigh, Greensboro, Salisbury, and Charlotte. And as they're being moved back and forth on the railroad, I mean, this is obvious, it's taking up the transportation that is being needed to move the military supplies out of Wilmington, to move some of the stuff towards the troops that needed to be moved towards the troops. It creates absolute logistical chaos behind the lines in Wilmington. And what it means is that the Confederacy is unable to completely evacuate the city before Schofield's troops arrive. They lose major supplies that they needed because of this chaos with the prisoners of war moving back and forth. So once Schofield captures the city, by then there's enough communication, they figured out there's supposed to be an exchange during their campaign. So Schofield agrees to the exchange, and 8,500 prisoners are exchanged. But then here's the other thing, right? Now the Union Army is trying to stabilize and solidify an occupation of Wilmington and its surrounding counties when suddenly they have thousands of POWs who have just been in Florence prison. And if you know anything about Florence, I mean, these guys are sick, right? So they're trying to occupy and stabilize Wilmington and care for 8,500 POWs. Well, here was the problem for the Union Army. Caring for those POWs in Wilmington, even though they were able to move most of them out to Camp Parole in Maryland within a few days and weeks, they still had over 3,000 that they had to care for that were sick. This consumed the supplies that were being delivered to Wilmington that were supposed to be then transported to Sherman during his march into North Carolina. So Sherman's supplies are delayed several days because they have to wait for new ones because the POWs have used up all the others. And it delays Schofield's army from marching out of Wilmington for its rendezvous with Sherman for several days. So this is a case where the logistics of handling, transporting POWs has a direct impact on military operations. And I mean, I think this happens a lot, but we haven't tended to really study how does the capture and transport of POWs alter the conduct of campaigns. So that's a second example. So a third example, which I really am going to be very brief because this isn't my own research and I'm looking at people in the room, Angela, Rioto, Chris Barr, Adam Dombey, who do all of this much better than me. But I feel it's so important that I need to mention it. A third area that we see is POWs are very important for shaping how supporters of the Union and Confederacy interpret the Civil War and how they attempt to shape memory of the conflict. POWs are critical to that. Accusations about the treatment of POWs become the cornerstone after the Civil War for judging the conduct of the enemy and using outrage about the treatment of POWs to garner support for political policies. Okay, so POWs are a way of garnering outrage to support political policies. So the belief, whether accurate or not, the widespread belief in the Union that the Confederacy intentionally mistreated prisoners of war becomes vital to Reconstruction politics. So I already said the cornerstone of judgment and the outrage to support policies. So, for example, when Congress is doing its plans for Reconstruction, it is not coincidental that every time that the Republicans in Congress are considering a Reconstruction bill, they do an investigation of the treatment of POWs at Andersonville, right? Those two are linked for a reason. So in 1866, Congress uses reports on POWs to justify the Republican Reconstruction program. In 1868, the Republican political campaign used images of Andersonville as fundamental campaign images in that election. In 1869, considering other major pieces of legislation, the House of Representatives will investigate the treatment of POWs again, even though they've investigated it three times up to that point. So, you know, here's an example of this cartoon of Thomas Nast, of course, the famous Republican cartoonist. And here he's contrasting the treatment of Jefferson Davis in captivity, where he's surrounded by people fanning him and treating him well, with, you know, Union prisoners dying at Andersonville. In the 1872 election, Horace Greeley is the Democratic candidate. And this is a Republican cartoon making fun of that idea. Let us clasp hands across the bloody chasm, and it's going to show Andersonville. See, it's really hard for me to talk about this when I'm looking at Chris Barr, because he knows so much more about this. So I'm sitting here going, oh, I'm talking about stuff that he's the expert. But anyway, reaching across, you know, this image of the stockade at Andersonville. So constantly referencing that. And the one that I think is really the most interesting, I just found a random picture of guys in the Grand Army of the Republic. So after the Civil War, Union veterans join the Grand Army of the Republic, this massive veterans organization in the United States. And here's what's so interesting to me. The initiation ritual for the Grand Army of the Republic was blindfolding an initiate, bringing him into a room, and then he has to go up to a casket with the name on it of someone who had died at Andersonville while he was kind of actually even tied up. So the initiation ritual involves tying up an initiate and taking them past a coffin labeled with the name and regiment of a soldier who died at Andersonville. So we see this imagery of the Confederates' treatment of POWs are absolutely critical in post-war politics. And in fact, historians of reconstructionative memory will say that the issue of POWs inhibited reconciliation through the decade of the 1860s into the 1870s. And because this issue was still so divisive in the way it was used. So I've provided three examples, two from my own research, a third kind of glomping off other people, to talk about how POWs are integral to other narratives, larger political narratives, larger military narratives of the war. And so now Daniel and I want to do a couple of takeaways for us briefly.
And we're going to do an alternating. So we're getting real fancy here, So I'm gonna present some one larger point, and then Lorian, you can stay next to me. Okay, I present a larger point that we can maybe discuss. I already did before, and then Lorian gives some examples from some of the presentations and some of the people that we have here in the room here for today and tomorrow. So one thing that we want to look at, there we are, and think about in terms of takeaways, if you will. Prisoner of war treatment and policies concern that vital resource in warfare, that is people. Guarding, housing, feeding POWs is challenging and costly. In early modern warfare, my specialty, armies tried to get rid of POWs as soon as possible through exchanges. By the time of the American and French revolutions, however, belligerents often considered it worth the cost to keep enemy soldiers in captivity for longer periods. And some of the uses we just heard from Lorian. One for me is also important is just to deny these valuable resources to the enemy. The more difficult it was for the enemy to replace captured soldiers, as was the case in my case for the British during the American War of Independence, the greater the benefit for the captors. Of course, such benefits had to be weighed then against the fate of your own soldiers in enemy hands, because whenever you don't exchange, you leave them with the enemy. As we move into the 19th and 20th century, it seems to me at least, more and more value was placed on denying the enemy as many soldiers as possible. Less and less value was placed on freeing one's own soldiers. Ideology and nationalism kept the enemies apart, and ideology and nationalism also had to keep their own men loyal and faithful in captivity, even in the most terrible circumstances.
And so we're going to hear papers in this conference, I think, that address this issue of people as resources. So we're going to hear papers about the attempts of people when they're holding captors to get them to give information, to indoctrinate, to switch sides. We're going to hear papers about POWs trying to manipulate the system. We're going to hear papers about how cultural ideals of manhood and race also affect how these resources of prisoners are conceived of, used, and treated. And then, of course, how the prisoners themselves and their own view of manhood and their own racial views also impact that.
Yeah, another example, and I see Michael in the back, so I'll be very quiet here when I'm talking in detail about it, but there's always this economic dimension to captivity. Housing, feeding, guarding POWs was expensive, but POWs were also laborers, were also consumers, and actually could invigorate a economy. It could bring enormous benefits to a region. I mentioned the example of Winchester, Virginia during the American Revolution. Initially opposed to housing prisoners, once they had the prisoners and heard about the money that they would bring in, were very excited to have them and were very eager to keep them because they wanted to profit economically from that influx. In early 1777, as I said, in Lancaster, the people there discovered that a defeated enemy actually makes an excellent, willing, and cheap labor force, a practice, of course, with POWs that continues to this day.
And we're going to hear papers that touch on this today, but I think especially interesting, we're going to see extending that to considering environmental issues, how the economics of prisons and the need to care for these prisoners are going to have wider and sweeping environmental impacts.
Yeah, and then another topic is about state power and state building. And what I see important here is that keeping POWs is also about controlling people. About controlling space and territory, especially the regions around POW camps. As we have seen, POWs brought the state, as I argue, and its military to town. Of course, in the case of the American War of Independence, it's mostly a civil war. Demands on the local or regional economy and agriculture could be enormous when you have POWs. By the end of the 18th century, states were increasingly able and willing to use, though, their power of coercion and demand it from people to make a choice. Are you with us, or are you with the enemy that is right now in your midst?
And we're going to see papers, especially touching on the American Revolution and dealing with the issue of loyalty and constructing that, and then how the Union is going to use Confederate POWs as part of this concept of prisoners and state building.
Yeah, and finally, as I said, I wanted to also, and Lorian touched on it as well, that POWs were also always symbols, and there's a lot of rituals surrounding POWs, I think, that warrant more exploration. Humiliating, in my case, in my examples, humiliating the enemy through rituals such as the Trenton Prisoner Parade, or using them as powerful means to strengthen your own resolve and morale, or to communicate your victory. POWs could thus be used in that sense as symbols and for ritualistic purposes in warfare. They signaled victory and strength, and showcasing them in these rituals was also always about convincing the other side to give up.
And so I think we have several papers here that we're going to see in this conference this weekend that really assess the use of POWs as symbols both at the time, but then how they're used in subsequent decades as people are trying to continue to use POWs for political points, for military points, long after the wars are over.
So that concludes what we wanted to say this morning as an introduction to this conference. We're looking forward to. We're excited. I think we have a bit of a break now for to grab some coffee, and so yeah, we're looking forward to the rest of the day. And thank you very much. Okay, very good.